Yesterday I spoke a little bit about that cultural change. I described as a affective or emotional revolution, which is of course a cultural changing. But we have the structural sides of it, and I mentioned that, at least three. The rise of the affective fields, the international human rights system, and the rise of the creative classes in different countries. And this is related to the dominance of this new culture of the self. So then I'm going to take this issue of the human rights system, but not exactly examining the structural aspects of it, but also its contribution to this new culture. And I quoted Michael Ignatieff, a Canadian scholar. So this guy is very much related to the contemporary struggle for human rights, and I quoted him. Human rights has become the major article of faith of a secular society that fears it believes in nothing else. It has become the lingua franca of global moral thought, as English has become the lingua franca of the global economy. And I have had some contact with the international human rights movement, and this is totally true. They see themselves as the moral conscience of humanity. In some aspects, they really are like that. We should not just deny it. But this has important implications for Christian church. So I'll give a bit of story, and then we'll discuss the meaning of that story. But if we go to the beginnings of the human rights, modern human rights efforts, of course we had the First World War, which was a horrible thing, and that brought many people to work together to protect the human person worldwide. And one of these guys was well-known, this lawyer, René Cassin, a Jewish lawyer, which gathered some friends to fight for rights and protections for veterans and other victims of the First World War. It was as a result of that first undertaking that my most eminent colleagues and I decided it was essential to go back to first principles and to foster respect for the supreme commitment of those who had sacrificed themselves in that this war might be the last. Or so they thought. But this was the main thrust of the thing, how to fight for the people that fought. But of course we know that in the meantime, between the First and Second World, we had fascism and communism, and we have huge things. And in the Second World War, in the name of freedom, we had the Shoah and the genocide. And so René Cassin was already working a lot around those issues, and he was invited to be part of this new effort to bring a Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Abruptly, a world which had witnessed the serious, systematic, and innumerable violations that could be committed at the orders of a veritable gang found itself facing a problem of unsuspected amplitude to protect the whole man and to protect the rights of all men. I like that language. It became popular. And maybe some of you remember of the Lausanne Declaration, the evangelical one, which speaks exactly the same terms about preaching the gospel to the whole man and to all men. And it's reading like that. And I think there is some connection to it, because it became a way to speak about be attentive to the real persons everywhere. So this is the modern origin of the human rights. The experience of enormous power from sovereign states destroying lives of people. So this is different from the American Revolution And this is different from French Revolution. So you cannot just say it's a re-edition or something that happened before. It's really a new thing. So we have that in 1948. The UN accepted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This date is very important because 200 years before, it's 1648, we had the Westphalian Peace, and this was the moment the sovereign, more than sovereign state was actually formalized, as to say. It's a marking date. And we have that, the sovereign state, and then in 1948, we have an answer to that. Okay, we can have sovereign states, but it got to have limits, because they can really destroy their own citizens. So there is a deep thing happening in modernity, when we come from the Westphalian Peace to the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That date is just wrong here. So what's the emphasis? Dignity, equality, the rights of human persons, fundamental freedoms, fraternity duties, or brotherhood duties, I will speak more about that. And you have some of these big names, well-known big names. Eleanor Roosevelt was the president of the committee. And we have this Jewish lawyer, René Cassin, Jacques Maritain, the Thomist Catholic theologian, and well-known Charles Habib Malik, which was somewhat popular among evangelicals for a while. He even went to, what is that? Wheaton College to speak at some point. He was Lebanese and not just evangelical, but they were working together in that declaration. And I want to quote some of the ideas that those guys brought for that declaration. When we speak of human rights, we are raising the fundamental question, what is man? When we disagree about human rights, we are really disagreeing about the nature of the person. Is man merely a social being? Is he merely an animal? Is he merely an economic being? The deepest danger of this age is posed by a collectivism that demands the extinction of the human person as such in his own individuality and ultimate inviolability. So this was the first session of the Human Rights Commission. And people, the story tells that people thought he was very quiet and shy. And when he started to speak about human person, he got really enthusiastic and it influenced the direction of everything. But this is the important point, the nature of the person. There was a discussion about collectivism and individualism. The Russians were there participating, and they found another word to describe that, which is person, instead of individual. Instead of speaking about individual rights, they started to speak about person rights. And person would be more holistic because it could include the social dimension of the individual. And these just resonated to other people. Of course, we had this strong influence from Jacques Maritain in the same direction. He suggested the use of the term person, and he gave some content to it from his own philosophy to explain the meaning of human person and why the person should be the integration point to speak about the many rights that people were offering. Because they did a kind of survey and asked for different nations to say something about which rights should be included in the chart. And he argued that we should have an integration point to connect everything, and it should be the idea of person. And it got in. It became one of the bases of the Universal Declaration. Of course, lots of people could debate the meaning of persons, I mean philosophically, but as a historical point, Maritain's view and Malik's view it defined the game. It just happened. And then you have René Cassin. We'll go very much to him at some point here. Human rights are an integral part of the faith and tradition of Judaism. The belief that man was created in the divine image, that a human family is one, and that every person is obliged to deal justly with every other person, are basic sources of the Jewish commitment to human rights. So there was a strong Judeo-Christian basis for that when it actually happened, when they started to think about how to organize the modern discourse of human rights. The emblem of the Universal Declaration recalls the duty of human fraternity, inspired by that master precept, love thy neighbor as thyself. May it partake, despite its purely human origin, of the greatness of the Decalogue, and appear as its worthy extension. I want to bring your attention to that. It wasn't only René Cassin which was thinking this way, as the Human Rights Declaration, as an extension of biblical morality. This wasn't like said afterwards. This was thought when the Declaration was being written, even with all the religious diversity and political discussion that was happening. So it's not easy for Christians to dismiss that as a kind of human secular peace, because it is not like that. There is a Christian influence, and we are somewhat responsible for the outcomes of it. And I will tell a little bit about that story, about that influence, and what Dr. Cassin said in that respect. Some of you know Michael Walzer for his reading on justice and political philosophy, so I like his spheres of justice particularly. But he wrote that book, which is very interesting, Exodus and Revolution. And he presents that reading, that political reading of Exodus, which resonates with Jewish understanding of the covenantal process in primitive Israel. And, you know, Michael Walzer wrote also about the Protestant Revolution, the Revolution of Saints, about the English Puritans. So he is very much interested in this kind of radical movements and thinking in religion, from religion. And he went to the English Puritans and also to Exodus. And he has found something interesting there. Covenant is the political invention of the book of Exodus. There is no precedent for a tractate between God and an entire people, or for a treat whose conditions are literally the laws of morality. And this is the important point for René Cassin, is that the Decalogue is the moral basis for something. It's the moral basis even for the human rights talk. And you have, of course, the law, God's law, together with the covenant. But God's law is not a jurisprudence, as we have like our constitution here. It's more an instruction. John Walton has written about that, like in his book, The Lost World of the Torah. And he explains like we should understand the law not just as formal law, like legal law, but as moral law. And it influenced early Protestant political thinking. So Beza, which was the successor of Calvin, he wrote about the right of the magistrate. And he famously said like that, the people existed before there was any magistrate. And the magistrates were made for the sake of the people. and not vice versa. This is very interesting, because people didn't think like that at this time. And this was an important step to have modern civil rights. So this was a basis for Geneva and other cities in Switzerland, and it spread around. Actually, he was somewhat influenced by Goodman, a British thinker, a theologian, but it spread around. And John Witt has written an amazing book about that, The Reformation of Rights. I would strongly recommend to everyone. It's a great book. And he sees in Calvinism the beginning of a theory of constitutional political covenant. And these are the influences, the same things that actually Michael Walzer has found studying Exodus. And at some point I'll quote him here. In addition to requiring obedience to the laws of God and nature, the political covenant required political rulers to protect and promote the rights and liberties and privileges and freedoms of their subjects. The people were not created for the sake of the rulers, but the rulers for the sake of the people, Beza proclaimed famously. And in order to protect the people, rulers were required to protect and respect their basic rights. Like Gutmann before him, Beza looked to the Decalogue as a convenient source and summary of the most basic rights of the persons. But of course, he reasoned it like the other way around. So if there are duties regarding people, those people must have some rights. So he started with the moral basis to develop a law language, for a constitutional language. And he was influenced by the Decalogue for doing that. So we have the idea of political covenant, and you have laws to protect people, and you have the idea of persons. And here I quote Michael Perry. It's another important book toward the theory of human rights. He's a Christian. Tim Keller likes him very much, and in some moments. That there is a religious ground for the morality of human rights, indeed, more than one, is clear. And he quotes Charles Taylor, which says that universal human rights would be like a Christian thing. It is far from clear, however, that there is a non-religious ground, a secular ground, for the morality of human rights. So that's not just theoretical truth, but a historical truth. The formulation of the universal human rights from 1948 was actually based in a Christian perspective, in a religious perspective, not just Christian. We have Jewish also, and insights from other religions. But that basis was there. And it cannot just be dismissed, because there is no other foundation for that. The twofold conviction that every human being has inherent dignity and that we should live our lives accordingly is so fundamental to the morality of human rights that when I say in this book, The Morality of Human Rights, he has a chapter on it, I'm referring to this conviction. And of course, other writers have been pointing to that. So maybe you heard about his book from Nicholas Wolterstorff, Justice, Right and Wrongs, is a famous thing. You can debate, and there are criticisms to his argument, but at least his first part is very interesting, because he shows the beginning of the contemporary human rights talk, and he will find it in the Western fathers, church fathers. So it's something really old. And before that, of course, in the prophets. And he does some genealogy of the talk of human rights in Christianity. And it's amazing, the first part of the book. The second part, when he's discussing theory of goods and the meaning of rights, there are lots of debate. So, but there is also a Brian Tierney study, the idea of natural rights, which points the religious roots of it, and it was considered like definitive in that direction. So there is no like huge discussion about this or Christian origins of modern human rights. But then you have that progress, the Protestant Reformation, and then French Revolution being much more clear about rights and freedoms, but with some pagan like thrust, and I will speak about it a little bit. But at some point, Christianity starts to like to build a mediation and to admit we need to talk about rights. And you have Rerum Novarum from Leo XIII. This was 1893. Of course, you know, everyone knows now that Kuyper delivered and published his lecture about the social question and poverty at the same date the Rerum Novarum was published. So lots of people like to make comparisons, and there is lots to connect. Subsidiarity, I don't know how to say that in English, but it's very close to sphere sovereignty concept in Neo-Calvinism, and people like to compare both ideas. Anyway, it progressed in Christianity. But, you know, even René Cassin argued that this connection should be explicit. It is appropriate to make a comparison between the Decalogue, which is the departure point, to the present charter, which is our temporary arrival point. So this is the story. It comes from Exodus, all that thing of protecting people from Pharaoh. This came from Exodus. But there was a very interesting contribution from René Cassin, besides all the idea of protecting the person from the Christians present in the committee. We have the problem of duties, because they were looking for rights and how to protect the rights of people. But he says something when speaking about the Ten Commandments and the Declaration of Human Rights. Upon completion of the list of fundamental rights and freedoms, the writers of the Declaration were confronted by the insistence, look at this, of the socialist countries that express mention be made in what is Article 27. Of the duties of the individual towards the community. It seems that some of the delegates didn't want to speak about duties in the declaration. And it was the socialists telling that. They were supported by Latin American countries whose representatives had adopted a American Declaration of the Rights and Duties of Man in Bogota in the winter of 1948. So there was a talk about duties happening. But in the beginning, it was refused. Eleanor Roosevelt didn't want to talk about duties at all. And she was arguing against that in the beginning. So René Cassin retreated and decided to not speak about it. But in the end, he brought it again with an argument. Given our attention to the manner in which the Declaration envisages the duties of the individual to his fellow man, one notes that it formulates the most important mutual duty in these terms: they must act towards each other in a spirit of fraternity. And this is interesting, because freedom, equality, and fraternity, of course, we know that the language came from the French Revolution conversation. But when this is reread, revealed for the 1948 Declaration, the motivation to put it is the Decalogue, and not any French Revolution Gnostic thing. It had a theological impulse. Of course, there was the socialists. But the line of argument from René Cassin wasn't that. And when he started the movement to teach about human rights among Jewish, he would openly point to the Decalogue always. So this was the root, I mean, in that moment. And so he says like that, the emblem of Universal Declaration recalls the dirty of human fraternity inspired by that master precept, love thy neighbor as thyself. This is biblical morality. That's it. So it was connected to a higher view of the person from Christians, and it was part of the cooking of the charter. And then we have the setback. After the 1948, this is well known, we had a kind of division with the free world defending the civil and political rights and running the International Covenant in 1966. But we had also the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. And this was led by the Soviet Union. So we had a kind of division in regard to human rights. And the free world and the Americans would say that the civil and political rights are more basic than the other ones. And in terms of history, they must have a priority. So you cannot raise up the flag of these social and cultural rights in a way that destroy the first ones. And of course, the socialists were talking about human rights, but not practicing very much, you know that. But anyway, we had that discussion. And it was very much freedoms in a side, liberties, and equality in the other side. Despite their argument about fraternity, it was very much equality by state force. It was very much like that. And lots of people noted that the talk of fraternity, which came from René Cassin and other guys, wasn't actually being appreciated and taken seriously. But then, and I'm jumping again, our time machine, we go to 1993. So in 1989, we had the fall of the Berlin Wall, and it was a huge thing, of course. And people started to discuss about that human rights impasse, or people were stuck in that discussion about freedoms and equality. And this was one of the main points of the Vienna Conference in 1993, which was huge, the first global meeting after the Cold War, with 171 countries, 800 ONGs, 7,000 delegates, much bigger than the 1948 conference. And it emphasized how the many rights are interconnected and they cannot be separated because they refer to the same person. In a way, it's right, you know, because if the point of integration of the many rights is the human person, it's difficult to decide which one is most important than the other one. They must be interpreted dynamically, and you must be holistic. But this was a core argument. And they started to talk about minorities and vulnerable groups much more than before. And we had the High Commissioner for Human Rights. The final redaction of the text was by a Brazilian, which was in Geneva. And he was a friend of Fernando Henrique Cardoso, which was our president by that time. And he introduced in Brazil, and I want to give some of the local story there, the first national plan for human rights. Because we had and still have lots of violations in Brazil. So in 1996, he said like that, the fight for freedom and democracy has a specific name. It is called human rights. And they started to connect very much to democracy. This came from 1993. The idea that true democracy is not just political and civil rights, but also cultural and social rights. This is real democracy. It's to include people. And of course, this is connected to many developments we have now in also in America and other countries. And after him, the other guy was Lula, a well-known Brazilian president, which ran the country for a lot of time. And in 2009, he was introducing the third National Plan of Human Rights, and he said like that, "As I signed the presidential order instituting the third National Human Rights Program, the PNH3, I reaffirm that Brazil has made a definite option for enhancing democracy, also in regard to social and economical equality." So the idea is to, it was to create a middle point, you know, integrating the arguments from 66 from the free world and the reasons from the socialist bloc, also from 66. So people were intentionally trying to make this liberal, a kind of liberal progressivism, something like that. It became a hegemonical thinking in the human rights movement. So this was what Lula was saying here. But this is what the Democrats were saying in America. This exactly the same thing, in the same way to deal with things also. But when we go to, I'm speaking about Brazil here, but not just Brazil. When you go to the literature on international constitutional law and human rights, you get that. Individual rights against state sovereignty for a side, but for the other side, the states ensuring social rights to people. You have that everywhere now. In Brazil, specifically in the National Plan for Human Rights Education, it's interesting to see how people feel something was going wrong, because we were recognizing rights for people, but violations weren't actually diminishing. And it happened also everywhere. You have more and more rights, and society gets worse and worse. So what's going on? And suddenly, we have this setback, the crisis of democracies everywhere. And we had also in Brazil, you had your Bolsonaro, and we had our Trump for a while. It's actually, we still have our Trump. It's still there. And I work for him. That's the funny thing. So, are we having a democracy crisis? So, the former president of International Amnesty, and yes, he's a scholar, well known, and he wrote that article back in 2017. The dangerous rise of populism in regard of regarding that setback. Human rights exist to protect people from government abuse and neglect. This is very much connected to the 1948 declaration, as I explained up to now. Rights limit what state can do and impose obligations for how a state must act. Yet today, a new generation of populists is turning this protection on its head. Claiming to speak for the people, they treat rights as an impediment to their conception of the majority will, a needless obstacle to defending the nation from perceived threats and evils. So you have that in Europe, for example, against European community. How do you call it?
The Union.
European Union, that's it. And you have the Brexit, and other countries fighting against international human rights systems pressure over the sovereignty of local governments. So you have this kind of underground revolution coming on and coming in, and the populists earning power. Instead of accepting rights as protecting everyone, they privilege the declared interests of the majority, encouraging people to adopt a dangerous belief that they will never themselves need to assert rights against an overreaching government claiming to act in their name. This is just a comment, but I can understand his point. In Brazil, Bolsonaro at some point said like that, the majority must rule over the minorities. But we have something similar with government like really being tyrannical in some aspects in Canada, for example, which is very liberal. So this is the contradiction of things. You have neo-populism, but it seems it mirrors another kind of authoritarianism. And it's not just the bad guys and good guys. But I want to go to the fraternity principle, because I think part of the mess we have now in the international system of human rights and in the movement is the is that we have forgotten the fraternity principle as it was formulated in the beginning. There is a book which is quoted by Oskinas, Fire in the Minds of Men. It was also translated into Portuguese, and I think it's really important to understand the modern revolutionary faith. It's a huge book, and the guy knows what he speaks about. It's very well documented, very well argued, and he says this: in attempting to state simply the purpose of secular society and the popular sovereignty, the revolutionaries found three basic answers. Each was expressed by one of the words of the most important slogan of the era: liberty, fraternity, and equality. That's it. Each of these three ideals had ancient origins, but each acquired a new mystical aura during this period. At the beginning of the revolution, they had blended into a Trinitarian unity, but there were deep inherent differences between the three concepts, and much of the subsequent history of the revolutionary tradition involved recurring and widening conflict between these rival ideas. So you have liberalism, communism, of course liberalism emphasizing freedom, communism or socialism emphasizing equality, and nationalism emphasizing fraternity. It's important to have that backstory in mind, because these names, these concepts are changed in 1948 when they reintroduce fraternity. There is no nationalist color anymore. And this is important for us, because we can speak about equality, freedom, and fraternity in different terms because of 1948. Revolutionaries were generally sustained in such loneliness and despair and protected from ridicule and indifference by secularized 19th century versions of the old Judeo-Christian belief in the deliverance through history. He's speaking about the conception of time and future. It's a wider discussion here. But at a deep and often subconscious level, the revolutionary faith was shaped by the Christian faith and attempted to replace. It goes to morality also. These three ideas were corrupted versions of Christian values. And 1948 showed how to recover that. So even in the French Revolution, there was something of mannishness which could be recovered. It seems it happened after the sufferings of the Second World War. And so there is this famous Cassius Porta. This is the way it was really told at this time. It was his idea to organize the human rights in the 48 Declaration with that architectonic conception. And he would say like that: you have in the portal the introductory, the prologue words, which speak about dignity, and this is a reference of Christian personalism, which was present in the Declaration. And then liberty, equality, and brotherhood, but brotherhood in his biblical understanding, and this would be the entrance. And then you have the columns of the system, and on the top you have a formulation in the end of the Declaration, like to bides everything. And I will quote those, like the prologue and the ending of the declaration. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. That's it. You have personalism, rights, freedoms, equality is mentioned here, and you have fraternity. And this was the prologue, the basis of the whole thing. And in the end you have that. And this was the socialist demand. Everyone has duties to the community in which alone the free and full development of his personality is possible. So this was the way to save the idea of personality from mere individuality. It was a concession to the socialist, but it was a right concession. That's the thing. It was right, just right. Doesn't matter at this point what we think about state. You don't need to support the socialist view of state. But even with a wrong solution, there is a right question. The question is that individual is not enough to explain the human experience. That's the point. So it was accepted in 1948. But you can think about that from a communitarian perspective. You don't need to be a socialist to accept that. So I will quote here Michael Sandel, well known, and we have in Portuguese everything also. From the standpoint of the narrative conception of the person, the liberal account of obligation is too thin. It fails to account for the special responsibilities we have to one another as fellow citizens. More than this, it fails to capture those loyalties and responsibilities whose moral force consists partly in the fact that living by them is inseparable from understanding ourselves as the particular persons we are, as members of this family or nation or people, as bearers of that history, as citizens of this republic. So, in a way, you can speak about nationality as part of the experience of fraternity and brotherhood. This is not totally wrong. It's just that it can become an idol. Because, you know, the community experience in brotherhood has many dimensions. So there is the nation dimension, but there is family also. And there is neighborhoods, and there is religion. So when you speak about brotherhood, you should have a really rich and multidimensional sociology to speak about that. Or you're going to be like a socialist or a fascist. And now Mary Ann Glendon. She was even invited by this state secretary from Trump to run a special commission for a while. And it brought lots of complaining from liberals, because she was before that, she was a professor of Harvard Law, and she was a ambassador, is that right? Ambassador of U.S. in Vatican. She was like that. And she was succeeded by, who is this? I mentioned that yesterday. Another thinker. Anyway, I remember. So she says like that in Wright's Talk, which I consider a very important book. The American dialect of Wright's Talk deserves public deliberation, not only through affirmatively promoting an image of the Wright's beer as a radically autonomous individual, but through its corresponding neglect of the social dimensions of human personhood. It's interesting to see Marianne Glendon saying that, because this was the trouble in 1948, at least one of them. It was one of the troubles. They didn't have a concept of human person, which was rich enough to include the social dimension of things. They didn't want to speak about brotherhood in the declaration. They accepted that finally, but they, in the end, in 66, it was like divided. The free world going to a side and the socialist bloc to the other side. And the human person, like, it disappeared, the idea. The Christian personalism, which was present in 48, wasn't actually absorbed by the two sides of this movement, of the world at this time. And she keeps saying, because individuals are partly constituted in and through their relationships with others, a liberal politics dedicated to full and free human development cannot afford to ignore the settings that are most conducive to the fulfillment of that ideal. In so doing, liberal politics neglects the conditions of its own maintenance. For the institutions of civil society help to sustain a democratic order by relativizing the power of both the market and state and helping to counter consumerist and totalitarian tendencies. I want to point out that observation from Marion Glendon, that to have democratic order, you must find a way to balance individual rights and the healthy functioning of society. Because if you don't have a society really functioning, you cannot support individual rights effectively. It's not going to work. So maybe that is what is happening. We are expanding individual rights everywhere, in different countries, rich countries and poor countries. And we are not solving the troubles with violations, because the social structures of modern society are fragmenting. So it's not just about expanding rights. We need solutions to make people get together. And this is the principle of fraternity. Isn't even the equality isolatedly. It is the principle of fraternity. And she says, the myriad associations that generate social norms are the invisible supports and the sine qua non for condition for a regime in which individuals have rights. So that's civil society, that's moral life, that's church, family, and everything. So she's got a point here. But she's, of course, we know that in socialist countries, civil society is really weak. But liberalism is also now weakening civil society. After helping a lot for a while, now it's causing troubles also, because there is something unbalanced. When individual rights are permitted to undermine the communities that are the sources of such practices, they thus destroy their own surest underpinning. So I really like that. This is just perfect. And explains a lot what happened after 1948. Explains a lot. And so we can, this is a way to see the neo-populist or neo-sovereignist surge we are contemplating now. So I quoted yesterday Mark Lilla, and he said like that, we have a kind of politics that atomizes society, and that's the same thing everywhere, like everywhere, really. And it's now like, it's not as before, like you have a trend in Holland, and 10 years after or 15 years after, you have a trend in Brazil. Now it's like it changes in a country, and one year after it's changing in the other one, or maybe simultaneously because of our global system of communications and the global cities. So it's just at the same time. And we are having that, you know, this ruining of the social fabric of our culture. And it's related to atomization and this growing of individual rights without understanding duties. This was the question from René Cassin in the beginning. And we are actually talking about form and freedom. That's it. If you have such freedoms, and they start to destroy the culture, the relationships, the capacity of people to cooperate. Is what Schaeffer says. You have titanic freedoms and they become contradictory. Michael Polanyi has said the same thing. The trouble in Eastern Europe was freedom. It was a contradiction in the doctrine of freedom. This is his expression to explain the origin of modern totalitarianism. It's a contradictory doctrine of freedom. And this is implicit when we have a talk on freedom and we cannot speak reasonably about fraternity and include that in our programs. So there's something contradictory, something going on. And he argues that it has to do with education. Of all the developments I have discussed in this book, the most self-defeating from a liberal standpoint is identity-based education. The liberal pedagogy of our time, focused as it is on identity, is actually a depoliticizing force. It has made our children more tolerant of others than certainly my generation was, which is a very good thing. But by undermining the universal democratic we, on which solidarity can be built, dirt instilled and action inspired, it is unmaking rather than making citizens. In the end, this approach just strengthens all the atomizing forces that dominate our age. And you know, Jonathan Haidt has been pointing the same thing in his The Coddling of American Mind? Is that it? No, The Coddling of the American... The Coddling. So there was the first book, of course, The Righteous Mind. But and then he writes this other one, and he points to trouble with education, doing exactly the same thing, you know. And then I would point to... I didn't want to end with the Pope, end my lecture quoting the Pope, but I will have to. So he released that this letter, Fratelli Tutti, his social letter on fraternity and social friendship. There are things to be criticized. It's too much universalistic in theological terms, and there are other troubles. But in terms of what the world needs now and what should be the point of a Christian social presence, he is just right. And I must say that I was working on it for a while already when the encyclical came out. And so I wrote, like, I was so enthusiastic that I wrote like 10 articles for this magazine I write weekly in Brazil, just analyzing and discussing the implications of it. But I was already saying something about it before. Fraternity is born not only of a climate of respect for individual liberties, or even of a certain administratively guaranteed equality. Look at this. He's speaking about freedoms and equality. And this was the trouble in the beginning. Fraternity necessarily calls for something greater, which in turn enhances freedom and equality. So you can complain that the Pope is always over the wall. But I think he's right to be here over the wall, you know, and not affirming the freedoms, just the freedoms as the West, or just equality as the socialists. The point is that we need another thing which you cannot reinforce by a international system of human rights. You cannot create fraternity with a system of advocacy complaining of rights about rights violations. You cannot create fraternity from that. It's more grassroots. You know, it must be creating community. And that's the thing that politics and lawyers, you know, and advocates cannot build up. This was built up in the West through centuries of Christian presence, gathering people to take care of things. This was the way it was built in the beginning. And there's no way, other way to do that. So maybe the secular world is going to collapse, the modern West is going to collapse, because they tried to have freedom and equality or everything, actually in the end, without God. But this is reflected in the expectance to have a peaceful society without love. That's not going to happen, not going to work. So the Pope, I think he went right to the point. The principle of fraternity in a Christian understanding is the urgent response we must give in that discussion about human rights today. And this should be a practical thing. And I said I wouldn't end my lecture with the Pope. I was wise enough to not do that. So I will quote a Reformed. This is Dr. Roel Kuiper, he's a friend of mine. He was at the Dutch Senate for a while, and he was a worker at La Brie in the 80s, before going to the Senate, and now he teaches philosophy and theology at Kampen and other places. And he wrote that book. I think it is not in English at this point, but I managed to translate it into Portuguese and to make it accessible to Brazilians. And he speaks a lot about moral capital and how can we build that. So if we need a language to explain the principle of fraternity in terms that people in business and management could understand, I think he did the right thing. He developed this concept of moral capital, which is a enhanced version of the idea of social capital. It's much better and more Christian than like Robert Putnam ideas of social capital. It's much wider. It's connected to the Kuiperian tradition, of course. It's just amazing. I love that book. And I'm just saying that someone should translate it into English, you know, because I think it would be a wonderful tool to explain the principle of fraternity in very practical terms, which could be applied in church, in education, social development, in government, in different fields. You have a moral grammatics to speak to the human rights movement today. So my last comment about my point here is that I don't think we should dismiss the 1948 Declaration of Human Rights as something humanistic and just so. I don't think this is even true. And by the other hand, human rights is today the lingua franca of moral conversation in the world. And if we cannot articulate our Christian morality in terms of the modern talk of human rights, it will be really hard to be listened and understood. But it could be artificial, you know. My point is that it is not artificial. We have Christian slots in the international human rights movement to connect our moral talk, you know. So it would not be like inauthentic to do that. So this would be my proposal to face the human rights ideology today.